ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello and welcome to The Country Hour. Brooke Neindorf with you on this warm one today. Coming up, we're going to hear how things are looking out at the Oonadatta Roadhouse in this heat. And Fat Farmers launches its new health hub. So we'll have more on that very shortly. And we'll have a bit of an update on the weather. We'll have a look at some of those temperatures and also some total fire bans that are in place today as well. Before that, just to let you know, National Freight Services are being affected by several train wagons derailing late yesterday afternoon. Emergency services were called to the east-west railway line near Port Augusta about 5:40 yesterday afternoon. The Australian Rail Track Corporation says its crews are on site planning the recovery of several train wagons and the repair of the track. The derailment is affecting all services from Sydney to Perth, Melbourne to Perth, and Adelaide to Darwin. And we'll bring you more details on that story once we know more and what sort of impact it might have on freight as well. Now, it is a warm one today. You don't need me to be telling you that, but some of those temperatures are a lot around the 40s. There's some high 30s. A lot of places that haven't seen weather like this for quite a while and going over a couple of days as well for that heat wave. So I hope you're all going okay in the heat. Up in Oonadatta, it's expected to hit 45 degrees today, and I'm pretty sure it's probably around that at the moment. We're going to hear from the Roadhouse very shortly. But Isabella Kelly caught up with Douglas Lick from Todd Morden Station near Oonadatta around 9 o'clock this morning, and the temperature was already rising.
It's 36 presently and it's increasing, so I'd imagine it'll get to about 45, 46 today. But, you know, I've seen it all before. It's just a normal January hot day.
I mean, how hot does it get up there?
Last year we had one day in February we cracked 48. I think that was possibly a record for Oonadatta for February. It was 48 point something or other, but it was hot.
What's on your agenda today?
Today I'm doing a water run and putting some supplement out for the cattle. So, yes, that's what we're doing, just checking and cleaning troughs, tank water levels, and putting some feed supplement out for the cattle.
And are you hoping to have that wrapped up in the first half of the day before it gets too hot?
Nearly done sort of the first half. So we'll go back and have lunch. There's me and a young fella from Oonadatta. And then we'll have another lap a little later on this afternoon. But it's better to try and knock everything off in the morning, because it's the mid-afternoon that really gets hot.
You're obviously pretty used to the heat. What do you kind of do to keep cool?
Well, travelling around an air-conditioned Toyota and plenty of water. The homestead's well air-conditioned, evaporative air conditioner, and that seems to be working pretty well. It's a dry heat, though. It's not humid. It is hot, but, you know, you get used to it.
Have you seen many snakes and stuff around this summer?
Actually, I really think it's too hot for snakes, you know. Like, just imagine a poor old snake trying to go across the gibbers when it's 45 degrees. It's hot.
How did last year go for the station?
Rain-wise, was below average, about 50 mils below average. I had about 130 mils for calendar year last year. Our last real decent rain was back in March when we had about 69 mil. That was a bit of a saviour to have that rain. That sort of carried us through the year. And we had a lot of quite good cattle last year. And we offloaded a lot because I was sort of reading the situation a bit. And we sold a lot of breeders through the year. And there's pluses and minuses and everything, but at least it was into a rising cattle market.
So how's the livestock looking now, especially in the middle of summer? How are they faring?
Well, they got that bit of athletic look about them, you know. Obviously, they're not fat, but they're in strong condition because the place is so big, you know. There's some areas where the cattle are quite good and other areas where they're a bit plain looking.
So what's the kind of biggest thing that you're keeping an eye on heading into this year?
Well, obviously, every year is a challenge and there's always things on the horizon, you know, now China with the imposition of the tariff and then what's going on with Brazil and all of that and the lifting of the tariff there or the importation of beef into United States. So that all has a bit of an effect. But the main driver here really is the season, you know, and it's still early days in the summer and they've had some colossal rains in Queensland. So we always live in hope up here and, you know, we've got February and March where, you know, potentially we could still get a decent rain and, you know, things change pretty quickly if you do get a good rain.
Douglas Lillycrap from Todd Morden Cattle Station near Oonadatta speaking with Isabella Kelly earlier today. Now let's go to the town of Unadatta now, and Nicole Casignaro is the manager at the Pink Roadhouse, and she moved to the area about 2 years ago from England, which is a huge change from what she would be experiencing there right now. She says she's been preparing for the heat for the last few days.
We have been kept the blinds down. We keep the air cons going 24/7. And the windows covered. I even put my own shampoos and conditioners in the house because they melt, even my toothpaste in the bathroom. Take that all with me. Yeah, because it just all melts. It's crazy. Being from the UK, it's just, I can't take the heat, unfortunately, and I don't think I'll ever get used to it. Never think I'd have to manoeuvre my bathroom products to a cool spot, just, you know, even just trying to get toothpaste out of the tube, it just turns into sludge, really. It's gross. We've had Christmas. It's been lovely. You know, it will never be the same as Christmas back home. It's currently snowing there at the moment, so it's complete opposite weather. And actually swimming Christmas is insane. You know, having a barbecue. I'm used to sitting down in with the heating on, with a roast dinner, you know, hot food. So, it couldn't get any more different.
Nicole Casignaro, manager at the Pink Roadhouse, speaking with Tom Mann earlier this morning. And hopefully you're all going okay out in that heat. But up that way, they're pretty used to it, so I'm sure they're pretty well prepared. And if you are out and about in the heat today, please stay safe. We'll check in on that weather very shortly.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Marketing and R&D body Meat and Livestock Australia says it's disappointed with China's new global measure on beef imports. A 55% tariff will apply to all beef imported from Australia this year, above its 205,000 tonnes quota. MLA's General Manager of International Markets, Andrew Cox, spoke to Kim Honan.
I think the future still looks bright in many markets, but of course this will represent a constraint to the demand that we can access within China. And I think that's disappointing for Australian exporters and Australian farmers. I think it's also disappointing for our Chinese customers. We've got fantastic program business that we've developed as an industry with Chinese customers. And as I said before, we've got the trust of Chinese consumers as well. We're known for our quality, for our food safety, nutrition, etc. And of course, from a marketing perspective, we'll keep working with those customers with a long-term view.
So how do you see this playing out globally? We've got 100,000 tonnes of beef that will need to be exported elsewhere. There'll be, you know, other exporters that fill their quota and will have to find other markets as well. Ultimately, are we going to see, you know, exporters really lose out here in Australia?
I think it's important to note that the context here, that the macro sort of environment, trading environment for beef is still very positive. The demand outstrips supply globally. American beef is still in somewhat short supply, so we're exporting very large amounts to North America, Canada. There's opportunities throughout, you know, Southeast Asia with economic growth, etc., and wonderful conditions, and once again, a popular product amongst consumers and customers there. We've got opportunities in the Middle East. We've got opportunities in the UK. And hopefully we'll be able to access a free trade agreement with Europe in the coming months, which will also open up another market opportunity for Australian exporters.
And will those importers pay as much as China did for our beef?
Well, it's a competitive space. So, you know, like in all markets, you want as many customers as you can. You don't want to be beholden to any one customer. Our industry has done a fantastic job over the years to develop a number of markets. We've got four or five large markets that take a range of cuts, but there's also 20, 30, 40 other markets below that that compete for product. So a wise exporter will make sure that they've got multiple customers for each cut. Of course, whilst China's set a quota, the quota's still over 200,000 tonnes, which is in line with the five-year average. Of course, it's been recently a little larger to China. The US beef has been sort of cut out of that market. But we never know what will happen in the future. Obviously, the trade dynamic has been a little volatile in the last 12 months, but I think we're accustomed to volatility. If you look over any five-year period in the last 50, you'll have a number of volatile, you know, incidents that happen, and that's just how trade works.
Do you think there's any chances that China might change their tune and they may reduce the 55% tariff as the quota starts to fill up?
Yes, I'm not one to speculate on the decision-making of the Chinese authorities. So who knows? I mean, we'll just see how it plays out. We're still in the first week of January. I think there's a bit of discussion to be had between all affected parties. And I know that the Australian government is discussing this issue, this topic with their counterparts. So obviously we'd hope for relief because, as I said, we believe that we put an extremely strong case forward that any damages to the Chinese cattle industry are not at all caused by our industry. So we'd hope that would be taken into consideration as we go forward.
And have you heard anything from Chinese importers or consumers about how they're feeling?
Yeah, I think the Chinese side, our customers there are working through what this might mean. I think there's still, as we sort of discussed today, there's still a fair few unknowns about how this quota will be managed, or all these quotas will be managed, how they'll be reported, what it means for the product mix that will be going in. A lot of the customers that we have in China are program businesses taking chilled beef for retail shelves, much the same as you might see at Woolworths or Coles. So that sort of requires monthly shipments, and a 55% tariff would create obviously some economic challenges there. So they need to work through what this means for their businesses, and will support each supply chain that's involved in the Australian beef, you know, in importing Australian beef to maximise the potential opportunity for them.
And we've heard a commentary around this tariff having more of an impact on high-end premium products exported from Australia. Is that accurate, do you think?
I think it's hard to say. The most likely solution that you'd commercially look at would probably be frozen imports, because you can obviously freeze that product and then draw down on cold stores for a few months after the quota kicks in. That obviously would not be good at all for chilled beef shipments, grain-fed beef shipments, Wagyu shipments, etc., because, as I said, they have a shorter shelf life, chilled beef, and therefore rely on programmatic exports. So, yes, that's a risk for Australia, because we are the largest exporter of chilled beef into China. So we'd certainly be trying to protect that market, because it is a market that we don't believe competes directly with Chinese cattle, often found on premium retail shelves, targeting a different type of consumer. So that was the points that we put forward in our submissions to the Chinese authorities. And as I said, we would have hoped that that would be taken into consideration.
So how do you think Australia should manage this 205,000-tonne quota? China's a very important market for so many exporters. They're going to be scrambling to get their beef into there before the quota fills up, probably mid-year is what I'm hearing. There has been suggestions that perhaps that the federal government should be working with the industry peak bodies on coming up with a quota system to make it fair for all exporters. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's probably one for the peak bodies themselves. Meat must not want it for peak bodies. So that would be that the Australian Meat Industry Corporation and Cattle Australia would be discussing with Canberra. It's quite early. Obviously, the announcement came on Christmas Day, and we don't know how the quota will be managed. It's a decision initially for the Chinese side. We obviously manage a lot of different quotas all around the world, and that has to be negotiated between our government and the importing nation as well. So I think it's probably too early to say exactly how these quotas will be managed. But of course, what we'd want as an industry would be orderly quota management to avoid a sort of, you know, race to the bottom early on in each year.
Andrew Cox, General Manager of International Markets at Meat and Livestock Australia. Now, just over 7,000 head of young black Angus cattle were sold at the Northern Victoria Livestock Exchange just outside of Wodonga yesterday. Inside the yards, it was very hot under the tin roof. However, it wasn't enough to deter buyers, with prices remaining strong despite a challenging season in the region. One of the top-selling pens came from Tallangatta vendor Lang, with 309-kilo weaner steers selling for $5.79 per kilo, or $1,790 a head. Annie Brown caught owner Megan Peterkin in the sale yards for a chat.
I'm looking after my dad's farm, who passed away a couple of years ago. He primarily used to fatten steers into bullocks, and a few years before he died at the age of, you know, 90-odd, swapped over to cows and calves. He always wanted us kids to get, you know, he thought we'd be better off getting to cows and calves, so we got into cows and calves, and we're just in a stage now of building up our numbers of, yeah, Angus cattle, cows and calves, yeah.
Whereabouts do you farm?
Just the other side of Tallangatta, old Tallangatta, yes, George's Creek, yes.
And tell me a bit about how the sale went today here at NVLX. So big day for the wiener calf sales, and it sounds like one of your pens got one of the top prices.
Yeah, it was a very good sale. We're very happy with the results today. Cattle weighed well, they penned up well, and I think overall most people would be pretty happy. Like, people were a bit worried about what's going on overseas sometimes, but look, it is what it is, and it's good to get the cattle here, sell them, and then you just start the process again. So you just have to go with the flow, don't you?
So a good start to the new year.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, yeah.
Tell us a bit about what the season's been like just outside Tallinga around your way.
Yeah, we didn't have much of an autumn the last 2 years, so winter was pretty tough, and we sort of had to feed a few cows, and they got through all right. But the spring was quite good, actually. We've got good feed. We're grass-fed. And yeah, we've still got a bit of a green pick on the creek flats, and so spring was good. We weaned our calves early-ish, end of October, early November. So if the season went off, we could then sell the calves a bit earlier if we needed to, but it was fine. We've had not a bad spring, so we heads kept them for this sale and sold them today.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah. I guess in terms of these sales, it kicks off the year. Do you find this is also a bit of a test of where the market's at and how things are going at the moment?
It's probably a bit of a benchmark. Yeah, it probably just sets a bit of a mark for the sales going forward over the next couple of weeks, I assume. Yeah, they probably would, I think. And yeah.
Do you have any more cattle to sell, or is this today?
We've got a few more left over to sell. We kept quite a few heifers this year to try and build up our... We kept nearly 100 heifers to try and build up our numbers a bit more. So just a few odds and ends to sell now, but this is pretty much it, yes, yeah.
And so you trade under the name Lang after your father, yeah, that you mentioned at the top. Tell us a bit about your father, Lang. Who was he and what was he known for?
Oh, he was in the business all his life. I think he started when he was about 16 with Gippsland and Northern, and he died at 95, and he was still tangled up with Corcoran and Parker. He was still, he'd still get, buy cattle for people and sell for people, help organise cattle, still buying bulls, at a bull sale a couple of months before he died, and... No, he was very involved, and still, up until he died, he was still running the farm. I was helping him, but he made all the decisions. An amazing mind for, we'd be weighing cattle, and he'd be working out, what price we had going forward for them and what they'd make, and, lose 5%. And he was always so spot on with his calculations and his prices. And, yeah, he sort of called the shots right up until the end, and he was amazing. His mind, still riding horses into his 90s, loved it. And I think that kept him young, And all the Corcoran Parker people here were so good to him. Like, they'd ring him up, we're going to a bull sale, do you want to come to a sale? Or we're going to a sale, yep, and I'll come along. So I think that connection with young people is very good. And, I'd bring him down to the sale every fortnight, and, he loved it. Caught up with people and... Yeah, so, no, he loved this industry, and that was his life.
Do you think he'd be happy with the sale today?
Yeah, I think he'd be very happy, yes, yeah, very happy.
We've been asking a few people this on the Country Hour at the start of the year, but, what are your hopes for 2026? What do you need?
Good rain. Yeah, just... Oh, look, I just hope the market, cattle keep selling well, things keep going around as they are, but I hope we get some, autumn break this year, and hopefully winter's not too tough, and it's a bit of an easier year than previous years, but, it is what it is, and you just have to deal with whatever comes your way, and, yeah, and you get through it in the end, so, yeah.
Megan Peterkin from Tallangatta speaking about her late father, Lang Peterkin, and she was speaking there to Annie Brown at the Wodonga Sale Yards. Brooke Neindorf with you for the Country Hour today. Let's have a bit of a look at some weather across South Australia today. A ridge of high pressure contracts out of the southeast today as a low pressure trough moves in from the west, then pushes inland to the northern agricultural areas. This trough will remain relatively stationary and broaden over Thursday until a cold front clips the south, followed by a new ridge of high pressure on Friday. The trough will be pushed northwards out of the state by the ridge of high pressure, developing throughout by Saturday evening. There is total fire bans declared for today in all these regions. They're all extreme. The West Coast, Eastern Eyre Peninsula, Lower Eyre Peninsula, Flinders, Mid-North, Mount Lofty Ranges, York Peninsula, Kangaroo Island, Riverland, Murraylands, Upper Southeast and Lower Southeast. And where total fire bans have been declared, very hazardous fire weather conditions are predicted, and the total fire ban applies until midnight tonight. And the CFS recommends that you implement your bushfire survival plan if you haven't already. And to stay informed, you can go to the CFS website, cfs.sa.gov.au, or call the information hotline on 1-800-362-361. And stay tuned to your local ABC radio as well. And there is severe heatwave conditions in some parts of the state today as well. In severe heatwave, babies and young children, older people, pregnant women and people who are already unwell are especially at risk and can become ill. But even healthy people should take care as well. So take action now to make sure you and your family stay well during this heatwave event. Stay indoors as much as possible and make sure you're drinking plenty of water, even if you do not feel thirsty, because that's when it can get you. So carry a water bottle with you if you do go out, and never leave children or pets alone in a car. And the very young, as I mentioned before, older people and those who are already unwell are most at risk, so make sure you check in on them regularly. And make sure you check on your pets and animals as well, and make sure they've got shade and water too. Now, tomorrow in South Australia, hot to very hot and dry, apart from the chance of a shower or thunderstorm about the far northwest and far southern coastal fringes. Maximum temperatures above average, rising to well above average in the south, and fresh and gusty northeast northwesterly winds with fresh south to southeasterly winds about the west and south. Let's go to the western inlands now. For the upper western, sunny with winds northeasterly, 25 to 35 kilometres per hour, and overnight temperatures falling to 23 to 29. With daytime temperatures reaching 38 to 43. For the lower western, a sunny day and the chance of a thunderstorm with little or no rainfall in the southwest in the evening. Thunderstorms possibly severe with damaging winds near the Victorian border in the evening. Winds north to northeasterly 15 to 25 kilometres per hour, tending north to northwesterly 25 to 40 kilometres per hour in the early morning, then tending north to northeasterly 15 to 20 kilometres per hour in the late evening, and overnight temperatures falling to the mid to high 20s with daytime temperatures reaching the low to mid 40s. And stay tuned to your local ABC throughout the day for any other weather updates.
80 years of the Country Hour, Australia's longest running radio show.
Happy birthday, happy 80th birthday, Country Hour, from Richard Lay on the header at Port Vincent.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Thanks for joining me on the Country Hour today. Brooke Neindorf with you. And still to come, as part of those 80 years celebrations for the Country Hour late last year, we took a look back at some of the major stories that we've covered. And today we're going to hear about a record ram.
The old ram shed in Adelaide was absolutely packed. You know, media everywhere. The whole shed was just a buzz.
We'll have more on that story very shortly. But before that, the National Farmers Federation has taken aim at a federal inquiry into the value of skilled migration, saying it should also take into account unskilled migration. The inquiry by the Joint Standing Committee on Migration will not consider unskilled migration by groups, including backpackers and palm scheme workers. National Farmers Federation President Hamish McIntyre says that is a big oversight.
Skilled migrants play a very important supporting role in our agricultural workforce, but we shouldn't, you know, lose sight of the critical importance of semi-skilled workers and unskilled workers play also, Angus, you know, across our regional communities, whether it's our town councils or our shires, our contractors that we work with, you know, farming contractors and earth-moving contractors are all struggling, you know, in the areas of, you know, getting operators to drive trucks and tractors and heavy earth-moving machinery. So it's across our communities that there is a problem. So we just want to highlight the importance of suitable workforce for all roles that we do have in regional Australia. You know, the skilled ones do play an important role in our agronomy areas and, you know, as vets too, and also in biosecurity areas, all those things. Machinery maintenance, particularly mechanics, are very important too, Angus. So it's just getting that right balance that we do need a broad cross-section of people, and also highlight to our governments the importance of funding housing in regional Australia too, to support immigrants that come to, you know, do these roles and work in our communities with us and live there and create a life and a home. It's so important that we have suitable accommodation for them.
So is that then an oversight of this inquiry? Because if you read the terms of reference, it only refers to skilled migrants. It doesn't reference those unskilled or semi-skilled workers that you're talking about. Does that mean that they won't be looking at the importance of those people?
We believe so. So that's why we're highlighting it, Angus, that it's so important for our regional communities right across Australia to have those broad cross-section of people we just discussed. So I think it's very important that that government does understand it's probably semi-skilled to a greater extent, of which we are shorter of.
And how much has the importance of those unskilled or semi-skilled workers been on show just in the past couple of months through harvest? Because if you look at a lot of the people who are driving tractors or headers or running grain receival sites, it seems like a very large portion of those were your backpacker-type workers.
Absolutely, Angus, yeah. You know, as we speak today, we have Palm Islanders irrigating cotton for us up here and have plenty of backpackers working with us in our feedlots and operating machinery too. So, look, it's without them, we wouldn't be getting the job done in regional Australia at the moment. So it just highlights that importance. And we really want, you know, policies that enable us to operate sustainably and profitably with the appropriate workforce. So it is critical that government does understand the cross-section of people we need in our communities.
And if I talk from my own experience, where I'm from, Bort in north central Victoria, I know that the grain receival sites there were essentially staffed by a big crew of Argentinian backpackers out doing some pretty tough work out on the bunkers. That's the sort of work that it's pretty hard to convince local people to do, isn't it?
That's right, Angus, and there's plenty of willing backpackers and these Pacific and Island schemes that are very happy to do it and you know, enjoy regional Australia while they're out here. I mean, it's part of tourism for us and they love getting into our areas just out of the big cities. It's a very different lifestyle and, you know, something they'll always remember. So, you know, in our own business at the moment, I mean, we only have 3 out of 6 trucks moving today because we're down 3 truck drivers and it is just so hard to find drivers with the appropriate licences, particularly, you know, we rely on MC licences with our triple trucks bringing cattle in from the Channel Country back into where we background and feedlot them where we are and it's real. So we just want to really express to governments to consider all requirements and please not just focus on the very high-skilled immigration policy people.
Are you worried about potential changes to migration policy and particularly cuts to migration numbers in the future, perhaps at subject to political cycles?
Look, we'll stay out of the politics of it. We do need people in regional Australia, and so it's a case of government understanding what our requirements are. I mean, there are plenty of studies out there showing the shortages, so it's encouraging more of who come to Australia to move to regional Australia, I think, is a critical thing. And as I said, too, providing appropriate accommodation and infrastructure for them in our regional communities. I mean, we to be sustainable long-term as farmers and producing food and fibre here, we need really vibrant, you know, regional communities that have a large population and can grow. I mean, you know, we encourage people to hop off their planes and move west if you land in the eastern seaboard, or move north if you land in the southern seaboard, or back to the east if you land in the west. It's there's more to Australia than our big cities, and the more we encourage immigrants to come out and, for a start, I mean, obviously have a look, and as you're talking about backpackers, but then, you know, if they do decide to move to regional Australia with their families, we have the appropriate facilities for them, you know, including education, hospitals, and obviously housing.
In general, do you think Canberra has an appreciation of the importance of these workers to agriculture and regional Australia?
I think they do, but we do need to keep reminding them. I know politicians from our regional areas all do understand it. It's just, it's a great debate. You know, there seems to be still policies encourage centralisation instead of decentralisation is what we want. If you look at our northern hemisphere trading opposition, you know, right across Northern American countries and right across Europe, who we compete with for markets, you know, they have broad populations right throughout their regional areas and have people living all over those countries. You know, Australia's got a lot of areas probably that aren't suitable, but there's still a huge area that it is very suitable that we need to move people back into and have vibrant regional communities.
And the sorts of workers that you were talking about employing, Hamish, what's the attitude from them when they do come to regional Australia and find these sorts of jobs? What sort of attitude do they bring to work?
A great attitude, and it's also very interesting for our families and the people we work with currently. I mean, their cultural differences, the stories they have. You only have to have a beer with an Argentinian backpacker and the stories they tell about home on a Friday night to our people, or you hear them talking about it when they're working irrigating here, different things. See, it's just fascinating. So it's win-win. It's very healthy, and it broadens everyone's horizons, I believe.
National Farmers Federation President Hamish McIntyre speaking with Angus Furley. Now, the Fat Farmers Rural Health Initiative is hoping 2026 will be the year they can get more rural and regional people getting health checks. Late last year, they launched their branded Health Hub, which is a decked-out semi-trailer that can do on-the-spot health checks. CEO Richard Sheppey says they have plans to tour rural South Australia, visiting field days, conferences and community events. And he says it's a dream that's become a reality for Fat Farmers founder Ben Wondersitz.
Yeah, so I think Ben would have said that the Health Hub's really been a vision of his for a few years now, to have a purpose-built truck, semi-trailer that can go around regional rural communities and deliver some health screening and messaging. And that's, we managed to pull that off. Soft launch last weekend up at the Jamestown pageant was a great event up there. We had 50 people that we screened in conjunction with Flinders International point of care testing and Preventive Health SA. So yeah, really a great opportunity really to get the Health Hub out into the rural communities and support Jamestown. So it was really good.
Did you have to, I guess, prompt people to come and line up, or was there quite a want for people to come in and get tested?
We were really pleasantly surprised. You never quite know at events like this as to how many people are going to line up for testing, screening. You know what people are like in rural areas. They can tend to be a little bit sceptical about it, but no, feedback was really good. Uptake was really good, and we didn't have to herd too many people in. Obviously, the Health Hub, it stands out pretty well. Some people may have seen it about in the press. The graphics on it are fantastic. So it's certainly a bit of a conversation starter.
Do you think it has prompted people to follow up on some more health checks as well?
Yeah, I think so, without a doubt. What we're about is really trying to raise some awareness and education. So what we were testing for up at Jamestown at the weekend was cholesterol levels and diabetes, blood glucose. So I think it's always good just to be able to give people an opportunity, really, just to get a quick test, maybe see what their results are. I think there's probably, like, we can all be a little bit surprised as to what the results come back at. Some days I got tested for my cholesterol 6 months ago at the first one we did, and made me probably, let's say, rethink a little bit of my dietary choices. I did get tested again on Sunday, and please say my cholesterol's back down. So, yes, I think so.
Ben touched on this a bit when I spoke to him about the launch of the Health Hub a few weeks ago. But tell us about how the semi-trailer is set up.
So it's a fit-for-purpose, purpose-built semi-trailer. It's ex-Queensland Health dental van. So it's got two consulting rooms, surgeries. It's got a nurses' station, reception area, 5 air-conditioned rooms, wheelchair lift. So it really, really is, exactly as the name suggests, purpose-built Health Hub. We haven't had to do too much work to it, which has been great. Branded it up, tidied it up. We've had Hardy have supported us with a prime mover on the front of it. So, yeah, it's coming together really well.
What are the plans for the Health Hub moving into 2026?
2026, we want to see it really moving around rural communities around South Australia. We will be lining up at field days, shows, industry conferences, and also around a lot of our towns where we've got fat farmers and active farmers communities. We won't necessarily be screening in every town, but we will be partnering with different people, skin checks, point of care testing, also partnering with iFarmWell, with the Weather It Together campaign, etc. So really what it is, we've got a great facility where we believe we can probably encourage people to come and have a chat about things that maybe they wouldn't have done normally.
And Richard, I guess, if you look forward 12 months to, say, 2026, December next year, what sort of point do you want to get to by having this Health Hub? And if I chat to you in 12 months' time, what do you want to be looking at as something that Fat Farmers and also Active Farmers that you've recently joined with has achieved?
If we can have, I would like to think that we can have visited 20 to 30 communities around South Australia provided some health screening. So they re-roll the numbers up from there. You know, if we had 50 through in 4 hours on Friday, the numbers build up pretty quickly. The impact we can have is huge, but really, if it changes the life or saves the life of one or two people, you can't put a price on that. 12 months' time, 2 years' time, we would love to think that maybe we've got another health hub in a different state. Plans for us as the organisation is very much to scale this across Australia. Yeah, health hubs in multiple states is the big vision piece.
Fat Farmers CEO Richard Sheppey, and a fantastic effort there. Keep an eye out for that Fat Farmers Health Hub truck that will be travelling around South Australia this year. Very important cause that they've got there. Now, the next round of funding is open for researchers, grower groups and industry organisations to apply for the South Australian Grain Industry Trust Fund. SAGET is keen to hear about all projects, but particularly interested in work that improves summer fallow management, sustainable grain production and practical ways to reduce carbon emissions. SAGET Chair Dr Andrew Barr says SAGET expects to have a stronger budget following the 2025 harvest as seasonal prospects have improved.
Yeah, we think seasonal conditions for most of South Australia are a little better than last year, and so our income for research will be a little higher. And so we've just issued our guidance to researchers in the last week. It is an open call, so we're very much appreciative of the research community coming with any of their ideas to us. But we also give some guidance about things that we think are important around the cropping districts of South Australia.
And just remind us how funding is raised for SAGA.
So it used to be a flat rate of 30 cents per tonne. It's now a percentage of farm gate value, and that is currently set at 0.12%.
And so what sort of projects do you think might be looked at for 2026? Have you had a bit of an idea of what people might be putting forward?
Yeah, there's a number of areas that we think are important. Last year, there were a lot of dramas with carryover of herbicide residues, and so a lot of the agronomy fraternity spent their autumn looking at what would happen with the crop selection on those paddocks where there were concerns. And sure enough, there were a number of places where significant herbicide carryovers occurred, and hopefully most of the agronomists managed to choose a crop that could cope with that. But it's a pretty tricky area, and there are, however, some really promising leads in the research community about how we might better be able to measure and define the risk of herbicide carryover. So we're really keen to see projects in that space. Some of the other things we're interested in are crop protection strategies. We know that some of our main pathogens are evolving resistance to our fungicides. And so we're looking at defining what activity remains in our fungicides and also what other strategies we might do to control some of those diseases. So there are things like barley net form net blotch, which is causing us grief, and some of the wheat diseases like powdery mildew and septoria.
And are you looking at collaborating again, or if there's collaborative projects that can be done, say with SARDI or PERSA, is that sort of thing available again for 2026?
Yeah, SAGET is collaborating with a number of partners. We co-fund projects with SARDI, with the South Australian Drought Hub, and with GRDC as well. And that helps stretch the SAGET dollars further. And so we really value those. And some of the priorities of our partners are to look at capacity building, which is at present, it's between 20 and 25% of SAGET's budget is spent on investments either at secondary school or at tertiary level or early career for researchers to develop their careers. And we are very much investing in that space, and a number of our partners like the Drought Hub and SARDI are keen to invest in that space. And I think a lot of people will be familiar with our intern program, which we started with SARDI and then HART and then EP Ag and MINIPA. That's now expanded to Mallee Sustainable and MacKillop Farm Groups. And so we want to build on that program. And for the first time this year, we'll be offering the chance for early career researchers who are in their first job to travel to an overseas academic institution of their choice that offers the best short course training in the discipline they're interested in. So if it were plant breeding, it might be Cornell University in the US, or if it's plant protection, it might be Wageningen in the Netherlands. But as an incentive to get our early career researchers up to world class as fast as possible.
And Andy, is there a project that stood out for you from this year that that you thought did really well?
Yeah, I think we ask for projects in lentils because they are expanding rapidly into some of the non-traditional lentil areas. And farmers are having trouble with a couple of specific weeds. One is tares and vetch, and the other is capeweed. And so we funded two projects that with young agronomists, research agronomists on York Peninsula and the Lower North. And I think both of those projects made good progress this year. And so during the term of their project, we hope that there'll be some new solutions for managing those two very difficult weeds in lentils.
South Australian Grain Industry Trust Chair Dr. Andrew Barr, and applications for those grants must be received by Friday the 30th of January, and all relevant application guidelines and forms can be found on the SAGET website at sagat.com.au/funding.
The Ashes has never been bigger, so you'll need a big podcast. Join me, Corbin Middlemass and Ed Cowan on ABC Cricket Podcast, Monday and Friday and after every day of play. Search for ABC Cricket Podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, back in 1989, a South Australian ram was sold at auction at the Royal Adelaide Show for $450,000. It was double the previous record, the highest price paid for a ram in the world, and nothing's come near it since. As part of the Country Hour's 80th anniversary celebration at the end of last year, David Claughton looked back at that remarkable time and the disastrous collapse of the reserve price scheme for wool that followed it.
The old ram shed in Adelaide was absolutely packed, you know, media everywhere. The whole shed was just a buzz.
Bus coming to the 450,000, done. Once, twice, third and final for you, done, sir. Finished. All done. Thank you very much for the world record.
That's auctioneer Tony Wetherill, who sold the ram. He was just 27 at the time. He remembers the day because more than one ram sold for record prices.
The first one broke the world record. And then the second ram, I thought, we've already done the world record, so nothing's going to happen here. But I think the ram might have actually started about 50,000 and ended up taking $20,000 bids up until 450,000. So the wool industry was certainly on a high. You know, Collinsville was the leading stud in Australia, and the genetics were being sourced to go right around the world. So it was an exciting day. I think we would have had probably 200-odd rams in the sale that day.
Who was driving that price, do you think? Who were the money people behind it?
Well, Richard Nitschke bought the ram, Willoughby Leach stud in South Australia, but there was a lot of overseas interest. And back in the day, you know, Collinsville was selling a lot of semen, so that ram probably may have had orders for 1,000 doses of semen or whatever it, you know, $50 a dose. So
there's 50 grand in the bank.
there's already a discount straight away. So it just doesn't seem real today, to be honest. But it was certainly a highlight of my career. And I have sold a ram for $100,000 since then. But, you know, the days of getting back to $450,000, who knows? It may happen one day, but it's a long way off at the moment.
Lee Radford was working on the ABC's Country Hour program in South Australia at the time. He was at the Adelaide show and puts the story at the top of his list of memorable career moments.
It was just extraordinary that that amount of money was paid for a single stud ram. And it's still current. The world record price for a stud merino ram was set at the Adelaide show, but it was right at the top of the ride for the Australian wool industry, where literally the national economy was riding on the sheep's back. It was so lucrative for the country. And Parliament knew that, and it was always talked about in that era because it was such a significant export earner for the country.
In the 1950s, wool was 30% of the nation's exports, selling for $37 a kilo. But the end of the Korean War sent the economy into recession and demand for wool with it. By the 1980s, a wool stockpile was building up due to the creation of the reserve price scheme for wool. That was set up to smooth out fluctuations in prices, with the Australian Wool Council buying product that didn't sell at the minimum price. It was stored and sold later when the market recovered. But sometimes 90% of the offering didn't reach the floor price. Despite the looming problem, growers were still making a lot of money, and excitement around the Collinsville stud was generated by a new owner, West Australian Neil Garnett. He paid $10 million for the stud in 1985 and started building up the artificial insemination side of the business. The world record sale price for a merino was broken six times under Garnett's ownership, with the run culminating in the ram called JC and S Luster 5.
He's undoubtedly the best sheep we've ever sold. He has an incredible length of staple, and he has very hard to breed this sort of sheep.
It couldn't last forever, and Lee Radford told the story of the record ram and the collapse of the reserve price scheme in a special report for ABC Current Affairs.
The wool industry peaked in 1989, 2 years ahead of the crash of the reserve price scheme, when a world record $450,000 was paid for a Collinsville Merino ram.
People felt overconfident. Supply started to run ahead of demand. The prices got up to over 1,200 cents a kilogram on an average basis, and the floor price was running at about 870 cents at that time, but it was like printing money. It became too good. And so wool growers just increased their production to a point where there was too much in stock, and of course more and more wool was being taken in under the scheme, up to 4.7 million bales.
It was a shocking performance by both government and industry.
Primary Industries Minister John Kerin faced almost as many opinions on what to do as sheep themselves. But at the end of the day, a once great industry was brought to its knees. By the mid-1990s, the recovery has not come. More than 3 million bales remain in the stockpile, and more once proud wool growers are being pushed over the edge. The days of riding on the sheep's back are no more.
Lee Radford with that report. Another man who was at the auction that day was Tim Deller. He was just seven, but he remembers the excitement in the air. He went on to work in the wool industry and eventually got a job with Collinsville as their stud manager. I asked him what happened to the world's most expensive ram.
He would have went to work. He went to the AI centre and collected a lot of semen. A lot of people used him through AI. Yeah, he threw a lot of progeny.
Not enough to pay back the investment, however. Richard Nitschke's stud has since dispersed, and the Collinsville stud went into receivership in 1991, owing $43 million. Peter Lewis reported on the financial troubles at Collinsville in a 1995 report on the ABC's 7:30 report.
Garnett borrowed big time to achieve his artificially inseminated dream, but as it turned out, he was clutching at straws. The market for his expensive designer sheep hopelessly overestimated. And by the end of 1991, Garnett had set a record himself. With personal debts of $43 million to the state bank, he was South Australia's biggest individual bankrupt.
Peter Lewis. Paddy Hambury, a nephew of Rupert Murdoch, bought Collinsville in 1995 and later sold it to George Millington. Tim Deller came on board as stud manager in 2008, and he's been there now for 17 years.
Yes, so Collinsville was sold to the Hambury Group. And then Paddy Hambury and his family had Collinsville for approximately 20 years. And then 11 years ago, George Millington purchased Collinsville. And I've been at Collinsville for 17 years, so I've seen the last decade and a half. So we don't chase rainbows. We don't try and breed sheep for environments that don't suit us.
The stud continues to top competitions and auctions across the country. But wool prices are in the doldrums. The national wool clip is likely to be the lowest in 100 years. And key wool-producing areas are in drought. Collinsville is experiencing the worst of that.
Yeah, worst ever, as far as lowest rainfall. Collinsville was established in 1889, so, yeah, lowest rainfall on record.
And Lee Radford? He's still broadcasting on the ABC and active in agriculture in South Australia and around the world. But he regards his long time working with ABC Rural as his finest hour.
It has been such a privilege to be able to travel all over Australia to some of the most far-flung remote parts of our country, and to cover things that matter in those places, and to meet the extraordinary people who are the backbone of this country, who do amazing things in their own parts of the world in their own very understated ways often.
Lee Radford ending that report by David Claughton. And we did celebrate the Country Hour's 80th birthday on December 3rd at the end of last year. And there's still plenty of great stories online at abc.net.au/rural looking back at what Country Hour has done over those 80 years. Now, another fantastic thing that the ABC has been involved with is Haywire. And have you ever felt like the things that you find hard, everyone else finds easy? Well, that was the case for Haywire winner Geordie, until a diagnosis of ADHD and dyslexia helped explain her learning differences. Here's her story.
For a long time, I thought I struggled to learn because I just wasn't smart. I didn't think it could improve. I thought it was just something I had to deal with. I wasn't good at reading or spelling. Similar letters, like D's and B's, would get flipped around. And I would always get bored, lose focus. Like in class, if there was a fly and it landed on someone's shoe, then I would think about the shoe, then the colour of the shoe, then where I had seen that colour the other day. It would become a long chain of thoughts instead of focusing on what I'm actually meant to be doing. All I could hear was my own thoughts. In year 8, Mum started taking me to appointments with doctors and specialists to figure out why I was struggling to learn in school. It took years to get any answers, but eventually I was diagnosed with ADHD and dyslexia. At first, I was embarrassed about being different and carrying a label and needing different learning support at school. But I was also relieved to have an explanation for why I couldn't learn the way my classmates could. The first day on medication, I remember instantly being able to do so much work. Pretty soon, teachers noticed how much better I was doing. It was way easier and less stressful to just go to school and complete each day. I got way more confident in class. I went from struggling in exams to acing them. Now, if there's a fly in the room, I might notice it, but it won't distract me. I can stay focused on what I'm doing. But there are downsides too. Every morning, I look at my ADHD tablet and wonder whether I should swallow it. I know it helps me learn, but I feel like it hides the real me. I go from being hyperactive and outgoing to being focused and quiet. My friends are really supportive and much more aware of ADHD and dyslexia now. But I think my journey would have been much easier if I had known someone like me and they had been open about it. I could have recognised the symptoms and struggles and done something sooner. Now, I have more acceptance and understanding of my learning differences. I hope being open about it might just help other people know they're not alone.
That was Geordie from Broken Hill with her winning Haywire story. And Geordie will be travelling to Canberra at the end of this month for the Haywire Regional Youth Summit. So we're going to check in with some of their state winners while they're over there in Canberra. And you can read Geordie's story and all the other stories of all the other Haywire winners by going to abc.net.au/haywire. Now, finally today, let's find out how the Doubler markets went yesterday. And Elsie Adamo has the numbers. Hi, Elsie.
Good afternoon, Brooke. A modest 4,800 lambs and 900 sheep were presented for the first sale of 2026. Quality was mixed, with very few trade lambs on offer. The usual trade and processor buyers were active, along with feeder and restocker orders, as prices reflected the quality on offer. Hoggets and mutton were in demand, with prices considerably better than late last year. Crossbred light young lambs sold from $160 to $170, as store descriptions range from $200 to $215. Trade weights range from $240 to $255, with heavy weights selling from $240 to $250 per head.
New season Shawn heavy crossbreds range from $280 to $300 per head. New season heavy merinos sold from $245 to $255. Heavy trades range from $195 to $220, with lighter weights selling from $170 to $180 per head. Hoggets sold from $170 to $250 per head. Heavy mutton range from $210 to $260. Trade weights range from $170 to $190, with light weights fetching $135 to $155 per head. This has been Elsie Adamo presenting a report prepared by John Traeger for the MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks, Elsie. Elsie Adamo there with those numbers from the Doubler Market. That's all we've got time for on the Country Hour today. Thanks very much for joining us. Don't forget to jump online to read more great stories at abc.net.au/rural. Stay cool this afternoon. Check in on those that might be affected more by this heat, and that if you can stay inside, please do, and stay tuned to your local ABC radio for updates. I'm Brooke Neindorf. Thanks for your company.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.